Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and today marks the beginning of Phase 2 for Massachusetts as the state takes another step toward a new normal in the wake of this coronavirus pandemic. So what does that mean? What can open this week? What will that opening look like? Who will go? For more, we're joined by WBUR's Zeninjor Enwemeka. Zeninjor, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
So I know retail stores and restaurants are a couple of the industries that now have at least some green light. Can you give us an overview of what's open and some of the restrictions that they now have to follow?
Yeah, so all retail stores are allowed to open in the state today. So that would be like bookstores, clothing stores, jewelers, those types of shops that were previously deemed non-essential. There are, of course, some restrictions. Retail stores have to limit their capacity to 40% so people have enough space to distance themselves. There's also safety protocols, so extra cleaning and disinfecting that they have to do, also installing plexiglass shields at checkout. So shopping will certainly be different. For example, in clothing stores, dressing rooms won't be open. So that's something for shoppers to think about. And overall, the changes will be largely similar to what people already see at grocery stores.
So what didn't make the cut? What's got to wait till phase three or even phase four?
Yeah, so a lot of the arts and entertainment won't happen until phase three and in some cases phase four. So bars and museums aren't allowed to open yet until phase three. Also gyms and casinos are not allowed to reopen yet. And large venues and nightclubs are set to be allowed to reopen not until phase four for those ones.
On casinos, just to clarify, are the hotel parts open and not the gaming floors, or are they entirely closed?
Yeah, so lodging is allowed to reopen. So hotels, other lodging establishments, the casino part refers to the gaming portion. Yeah.
Got it. So what's the reaction been like across the business world? Do people approve of the way the governor's been handling this reopening? What are you hearing?
Well, many business owners certainly understand the public health concerns. In some ways, the public health concerns impact their customers, you know. So at the same time, of course, businesses have taken a huge hit. Bob Lutz, the president and CEO of the Massachusetts Restaurant Association, says the extended closures has definitely put some restaurants out of business for good.
My best intel tells us that about 3,600 restaurants will not reopen. That's out of 16,000 restaurants. That's a pretty significant number.
And it's also important to note that for some businesses that can reopen, there are a lot of logistics to consider whether it's even really feasible for them to reopen. John Hurst of the Retailers Association of Massachusetts says that for retailers who can now open, there are still financial decisions that have to be made about whether it's the right move.
The reality is there are going to be some costs of compliance, and that might factor in with some of these small businesses on whether they make that investment on day one. Some may choose to remain closed for a little longer.
Yeah, and I've already noticed that. I was just out doing some reporting in Cambridge, and I noticed there are many stores still closed, even though they are allowed to open now. And some of the stores that are open have actually cut back their hours significantly.
What are you hearing, if at all, about concerns about a second spike or wave of coronavirus infections as we continue to loosen restrictions?
Yeah, I think there is that concern, and that's something that, you know, many businesses are taking the safety precautions seriously because of those concerns. That concern may also be why some businesses aren't reopening, because they may not be able to comply with the safety requirements that the state has put forth.
So let's stay on that for a second. We have seen large sustained demonstrations over the past week or so here in Massachusetts, across the country, all in the wake of George Floyd's killing and out of frustration about police brutality. How are folks thinking about the juxtaposition there, that we're asking people to social distance, we have restrictions around the reopening, and at the same time, people have felt strongly that it's necessary to assemble to protest, where it can be very difficult to keep up that kind of social distancing?
Yeah, I mean, the protests are certainly something people are thinking about, including businesses. I spoke to one today who actually brought it up. just in the context of, you know, waiting for customers to come back. That particular business hasn't really seen a lot of customers coming in yet. They've been getting some calls. So it's certainly something people are thinking about as we move into this next phase of reopening, which itself will be a process as we're in this much larger moment.
Okay, because the Ninja, I'm really glad you've decided to join us. If you will you stay there? Because I want to bring in another voice on the reopening.
Sure.
So thanks. So joining me now on the line, we actually have two people, Roy Avellaneda. He's president of the Chelsea City Council, also owner of a restaurant there. And joining us is also the Chelsea City Manager, Tom Ambrosino. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Roy, I want to start with you. We've talked to you before also about your business. As a business owner, when we last checked in, you converted your restaurant to food distribution while it was closed. How is that going? What's the status there?
Well, the pop-up food pantry has been relocated out of the Pani Cafe, which was the coffee shop cafe that I helped start at and out of, and to their larger location because of the demand and need of that operation. But I still remain closed in the Cary Square area. And honestly, I don't plan on opening until September, despite the loosening of restrictions, because there's more to it on a business side, more factors in the decision than just the you know, lifting of the restrictions. There's other things that
right. Why to take into. Why yep. September in particular? What's kind of going on in your head about that decision?
Well, a lot of my business caters to school activity that goes on. In my corner over there, I have a nearby school, and I have also that area is a area where there's a bus stop for school buses, and so I depend on all of that traffic, and that is not occurring right now. Also, across the street from my location is one of the major bus stops for the 111 bus, and we routinely are selling to people who are shuffling to work. And on every 15 minutes, you can count about 10 to 20 people waiting at that bus stop. And the business and the office, you know, work in the city of Boston just hasn't come back yet. So Chelsea's unemployment rate is still very high. And I feel that if I was to open up and put in the effort of spending money to separate, put up the plastic panels and such and have my employees there, that the numbers just don't work. It's hard enough to make it. Yeah. It's
well,
hard
I'm,
enough
I'm
just to make
sorry.
It. It's hard enough to make it on a regular in a regular setting to put on additionally the restrictions and knowing that you're going to have a low account, customer count just makes it not really worth the effort.
Roy, before I turn to Tom, which I want to do in just a minute, what does that mean for you, for the employees of Pani Cafe financially? To be waiting until September?
Well, you know, again, I'm in a different scenario with that I, in fact, I own my own building. So I'm not depending on the rent portion that I have to face. I've talked to my employees, but they understand that in order for the business to survive and be able to pay them, you know, we have to be profitable and it just doesn't work. So I hope that they will be back with us when we come back. And obviously there's unemployment going on, unemployment benefits going on, and hopefully I'll be able to get them if they're not already joining somewhere else. But it's a real decision. I hate to do it, but it's the realities of what's going on today and what small businesses like myself have to face.
Let's add Tom Ambrosino in here. Tom, you're the city manager for Chelsea. Does today, day one of phase two, does this feel like a big deal today?
I mean, I think people are going to be cautious here on both sides of the equation, both our business owners and our residents, in terms of getting back to normal business activity. I don't think Roy's situation is all that unique. I think there's going to be lots of business owners who worry that the activity around them that they depend upon for business isn't there yet. In Roy's situation, it's a school activity, and other situations in Boston or even here, it might be office activity that isn't quite back to normal yet. So I think there's going to be caution on the business side, and I think there's caution on the customer side as well. People a little nervous about getting back to normal, but hopefully over time, and especially if our numbers, our health numbers, continue to be as good as they have been the last few weeks, I think people will start to feel a little more confident.
Chelsea was especially hard hit, in fact, probably arguably disproportionately hard hit here in the Commonwealth. Does this pacing feel right to you, and does it feel like the needs of your community have been taken into account?
You know, certainly Chelsea was disproportionately impacted, and even though the health numbers are substantially improved, certainly the economic impact is not, and that's going to linger for a long time. I think there is a need for cities like us to try to get back to some level of economic activity in order to get people back employed and to get our economy moving a little bit more. I think the governor's efforts have been thoughtful. No one's ever going to agree 100% with anyone's plan, but I think it has been a slow, cautious approach, and so far we haven't had any issues in Chelsea in terms of this reopening. There is concern of a second wave and increase in cases. We're watching the numbers closely every day, and so we can be prepared to act quickly if that surfaces.
Roy, Tom, I'll ask you this together. Do you feel that the state has supported Chelsea adequately through all of this? Have you had the resources that you need, the technical support, the communication, et cetera?
You know, I feel the governor was extremely supportive for us over the past 2 months in terms of helping us with our food needs through the mobilization of the National Guard, and helping us stand up that hotel in Revere that was incredibly beneficial to our residents in terms of putting some pressure on some of the local healthcare entities to step up testing. You know, but the needs were and are incredibly great here in Chelsea. So we are still in need of significant financial support, both on the government side and on the social side. These economic impacts in cities like Chelsea and the surrounding ones around us are going to linger probably for at least a year, if not more.
What would you add to that?
I would share Tom's agreement. I think that Chelsea was in a tough spot, and the governor was listening, and I don't think any other community received the assistance, particularly when you talk about the National Guard coming in. And so the governor was definitely attentive. At this point, I would like just to say that Tom and our state delegation did a great job in conveying our situation, and the governor reacted. So did a very good job.
So I want to ask you both, we know that COVID-19 has a disproportionate impact on the Latinx and Black communities. Chelsea is a majority Latinx community. What are Chelsea's needs with that in mind? And what are next steps and important decision making that both you and Greater Boston and the Commonwealth need to keep in mind to help ensure the public health and safety of Chelsea?
Well, Tom, I'll jump in. I just think that this definitely put a spotlight on when we became the hot spot of some of the issues, why we became a hot spot, because of some of the lack in public transportation and some of the inequities that we face. And hopefully, now that they've been highlighted, that when in the future planning, whether we're talking with our partners in the MBPC, or we're talking with the MBTA or in our state, that these inequities are addressed. And hopefully that comes out of it.
Tom, go ahead.
I would just say that it's these underlying society's issues that led to this disproportionate impact in communities of color like Chelsea, like the Brocktons, like Lawrence, like Everett. It's crowded housing and an insufficient number of affordable housing units. It's crowded public transportation and not enough investment in transportation to ensure that people can get to work in more comfortable circumstances. So I think the state has to start looking at investing more in more affordable housing, more public transportation. Whether that's going to be possible in this era where budgets are extremely tight and you're looking at massive deficits, I don't know. I think it just is more reason why we're going to need a federal government to step forward and help both state and local governments.
What are the two of you hearing from residents in Chelsea? You know, is there a blend of concern, hope, fear, relief? What are you hearing?
I hear concern more than anything else. I think it's just a concern. Obviously, it's a long way to go before many of the families living in Chelsea, the working class, are even feeling close to being whole. We realize that we all are itching to get back to work, itching to have a semblance of a normal life again, or what we thought was a normal life. But at the same time, we realize that the health concern is still out there. The vaccine has not come out yet, and we don't expect it to come out for maybe another 6 months or so. And why we are desperate to try to get back to work, because no one wants to go to a food line. No one wants to have unemployment benefits. That's not what we're asking for. We want to earn our keep. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we're not putting ourselves and our family members at risk. So it's that sort of cautious balance that Tom is talking about, that as things open up and as we are being called back to work, the essential employees and such, that hopefully that this does not end up with a trip to the hospital.
Tom, obviously in the news media over the last week or two, attention has shifted substantially from a lot of emphasis on the coronavirus pandemic to heavy emphasis on the protests, concerns about police violence and brutality, what's happening at the federal, the state, and the local level. Have we kept enough of an eye on the virus at the same time? And how does one in a community balance between the needs to protest, the resonance of those protests, and the need to remain cautious about pandemic spread?
Yeah, I mean, that is a tough balance, but I think those protesting are striking the right balance. Roy and I were both at the protest here in Chelsea yesterday that had a significant crowd, probably 500 plus. But amazingly, I didn't see one person without a mask on in that entire crowd. Now, the physical distancing was a little bit difficult in a crowd of that size, but I think most people, especially in this city, recognizing how virulent the contagion was, were paying close attention and making sure that they're still practicing good, safe habits. And I think that's going to be one thing that helps us in this effort moving forward, is that people are practicing safer habits, more hand washing, the mask, just being more careful. And I think that will bode well for us over the course of the summer as more and more businesses open up.
And Roy, just briefly, building on what Tom said, what other message would you have to the residents of Chelsea or to the larger Commonwealth?
Well, that we are inching towards hopefully a back to a normalcy, but we have to keep our guard up and continue to wear our mask and follow the same guidelines that Tom was talking about and that our medical community is telling us, that we have to continue to wash our hands and be careful. Maintain our vulnerable community safe. They're going to be the last ones, and we have to maintain that and be careful when we visit them or we're entering our households. But I know it's gets very easy to be cavalier about those safeguards, but we have to maintain them in order to make sure that we don't get another spike. And as Tom mentioned, it seems that our daily numbers, both here and statewide, are in the downward trend, which is in a positive trend. Two negatives, I understand, but that's what that means. And we're hopefully that we're going to be continue to monitor that, and that these safeguards that we have put in place and asked our residents to abide by works.
That's Roy Avellaneda, president of the Chelsea City Council and owner of Pani Cafe. Roy, thanks so much for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity to be on your show.
And Tom Ambrosino, Chelsea City Manager. Tom, I appreciate you as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
So still with us is WBUR's Zeninja and Wameka. Zeninja, thanks for sticking around. What's your reaction to what we just heard?
Yeah, so it's interesting. There's a couple things that stand out. One is certainly the challenges for businesses in reopening. That was something that Roy talked about, that, you know, in this reopening process, it's important to keep in mind that it's going to take time. So just because, you know, we have phase two start date today does not mean that everything will be reopening. There's certainly a lot of logistics and other factors that business owners have to think about. And also the concerns about the racial disparities that we've been seeing in this pandemic is clearly something that needs continued focus, particularly the underlying systemic issues.
So what are the biggest things that you're going to be watching for as we enter phase two?
I think it will be important to see how the reopening goes and to see how many businesses are actually able to reopen. In some cases, it may just be unfeasible for some businesses to comply with the restrictions. Again, there are other factors, inventory, cash flow, whether or not you rely on foot traffic or a particular type of customer that isn't really out and about right now, as mentioned earlier. So those are some of the things that I'll be keeping an eye on for phase two.
And Zeninja, before we go, I know this is a big question, but can you try to put this moment into context? It feels like we were in the grips of the pandemic. Now we're struggling with how and when to make this reopening happen. Meanwhile, we're still seeing protests take place across the state, across the country. How are you thinking about the intersection of these moments?
Yeah, that's a big question. And I think what has been interesting with this pandemic and what we're seeing with the protest and hearing about with the protest is this issue of inequality and equity. We're seeing disparities in this public health crisis disproportionately impacting Black and Latino communities. And that's what people are also calling attention to in terms of policing, racial disparities and inequality. So between these two things, there are really some fundamental underlying systemic issues that are very similar in both of these cases.
So one more question for you, Zeninja, and you may not be able to answer it because you don't have a crystal ball, but based on what you've seen so far, do you think we'll be able to stay on track and open phase three as has been planned? So far, it's gone, I think, probably smoother than some would have expected, getting through phase one and opening phase two.
That's a tough call. I think, if anything, this year, 2020, has shown us that we can't really predict what's going to happen. So many unexpected things have happened. Where we're at right now has been unpredictable. And so I think it's hard to say how things will go. We'll just have to wait and see.
All right. That is WBUR's Zeninja and Wameka. I really appreciate you joining us today. Thanks.
You're welcome.
As colleges face increasing financial uncertainty during the coronavirus pandemic, hundreds of faculty members in Boston could lose their jobs, and students are coming to their defense, WBUR's Fred Tice reports.
Clarissa Eaton says she feels like she's on the front line at UMass Boston because she and other non-tenure track faculty are the ones who connect the most with students.
We're there at the beginning. We're teaching the smaller classes sometimes. We're the ones that they'll stop by our office hours and just chat. And so I think it's going to be a really hard blow to the students because they're losing a connection.
Françoise Kayamba is one of the students who could lose her connection with Eaton.
She is a wonderful, wonderful professor. And she's really a professor who truly cares about her students. She would ask us how we're doing in class, you know. We would meet with her and actually build a rapport.
UMass Boston has told Clarissa Eaton and half its non-tenure track faculty that they may not be reappointed this fall. A spokesman for UMass Boston says, "We hope to be able to reappoint some of them, but that is not a decision we can make until our financial outlook for the next academic year becomes clearer." Across town at Harvard, Alex Corey, a lecturer in history and literature, expects to be laid off at the end of the month.
And lose my health insurance? and to lose my salary. And I'm the primary provider of both salary and benefits at this moment in my family. And also I have pre-existing conditions that make me particularly concerned about my being especially impacted by COVID-19 because I have asthma.
Corey worries about the students like Natalie Gale. She calls Corey the most influential professor she's ever had.
Alex will not be around going forward, will not be there when I write my thesis, and there's no guarantee that there will be someone in Histon Lit department who does have those research interests.
8 of her 9 professors are leaving this year. A non-tenure track tutor transformed Courtney DeLong's Harvard experience. She was miserable her first year, especially in one math and one economics class.
I had, a couple classes where I hated them.
Her sophomore year, she enrolled in an independent study with Lowell Brower, the head tutor in the folklore and mythology department. She calls him one of the best professors she's had.
We just got so much one-on-one feedback from him because he was actually like available to us, unlike a lot of bigger professors are. I went from really hating school to really, really loving it really quickly.
So much that she declared folklore and mythology her major. DeLong will be a senior this fall. She's upset that Harvard is not extending the contracts of about half its non-tenure track faculty as they face the worst job market since the Great Depression.
A lot of the non-tenure track faculty are people who, in my experience, go so above and beyond to actually help us grow as people and as thinkers and as learners. And it makes me really angry, honestly, because these are people who, for the most part, have been so integral to my education.
DeLong says non-tenure track faculty have been the backbone of her education, and she's not alone. This year, with the support of students, non-tenure track faculty petitioned Harvard to extend their contracts in recognition of the health and economic catastrophe the United States is suffering. So far, Harvard has not responded. That angers Saul Glist, who will be a junior this fall.
The idea that Harvard would not automatically renew its contracts with non-tenure track faculty, I mean, is infuriating.
Glist is studying Yiddish and history and literature. He estimates at least 50% of his classes were taught by non-tenure track faculty.
Every freshman who goes through expository writing, non-tenure track faculty, anyone who takes a language at Harvard, almost all of the language instruction is done by non-tenure track faculty.
At Harvard, non-tenure track faculty have to leave after a set number of years. It's called timing out. Glist says it's something Harvard undergraduates constantly have to think about.
Harvard has a pretty weak advising system because your academic advisors are constantly timing out. You have to worry not just about who's teaching the classes that interest you the most or whose research interests align most clearly with your own, but you're constantly worried about if they're going to time out while you're in the middle of writing your thesis.
A spokeswoman for Harvard says in some cases, non-tenure track faculty were granted an extension in certain academic areas. In others, she says, the university made new hires based on academic need. But students worry that some of their favorite professors might be pushed out during a major economic and public health crisis.
And that report from WBUR's Fred Tice. And now it is time for Mondays with the Mayor, our monthly call-in with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you have a question for the mayor, call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mayor Walsh, I appreciate you joining us today. We've got a lot of things to talk about, and it's a challenging time that we're in. I'm glad you're making yourselves available to us and to our listeners. We have to cover COVID-19 reopening. We'll do that a little bit later. I think the thing weighing most heavily on all of us right now is the protests over racism, police killing, and brutality against Black people in America. How are you thinking about the protests and what the protesters are calling for?
I mean, I'll tell you, the murder of George Floyd was horrific. It was horrific to everyone in America, but to Black Americans, it's nothing new. It's a part of the history of hatred and violence that's rooted in our country's past and continues through today through systemic racism. And what I'm seeing right now in the streets of Boston and the streets of many streets in Massachusetts and throughout the country is for democracy, free speech and democracy. And, you know, it's amazing to see. But it's been, I know it's been for a lot of people, it's been an emotional, challenging time. For me as the mayor of Boston, I've had many, many, many conversations now with my black people who work with me every day. And, you know, the consistent story, the stories are all consistently the same. And there's a lot of pain and a lot of hurt. And we have a lot of work to do as a country. But I can't focus on the country. I have to focus right now here in Boston. I do support Council Presley and her legislation in Washington. But we have to focus here in Boston to continue to move forward.
One of the things that has emerged during this round of protests, and I think it is important to acknowledge, we've had, you know, decades of protests around the relationship between police and Black America. But this conversation is really emerging around defunding the police. And depending on who you're speaking to, that movement ranges from entirely abolishing police forces to cutting specific types of funding. You said yesterday on WCVB-TV that you're not interested in, quote, arbitrarily cutting the police budget. But you did say that you're looking into reallocating some of that budget. What might a reallocation look like?
I mean, I just spent the last 4 hours here in my office in a meeting talking about budgets and on a whole host of issues. We're doing some critical thinking about how to fund public safety programs and what makes sense going forward. This is work that I've taken serious for a long time, obviously, but to go back, I mean, I still don't have a full answer yet, and I'm not going to announce it today on the radio because we're still working it, but, you know, we're also dealing with, you mentioned at the beginning of this, the COVID, and we're looking at anywhere from a $60 to an $80 million shortfall right now in our budget as well on top of that. So, you know, we're going to take this week to really think about how do we reallocate some money and how do we do it? Because we have to not only physically manage the city, but we also are now taking into account the events of what the protesters have been saying. And it's not just about defunding police departments, by the way. It's also about economic development. It's also about housing. It's also about health inequities. It's all of those different pieces that, in some cases, investments need to be made. In other cases, deep conversations need to be had about how do we create more opportunity.
There's been some proposals by Cambridge City Councilors just emerging to do some of that, to reallocate up to about $4 million in budget increases for 20 and 21 that might have gone to police into some of these other areas like human services and other forms of support for public health and public safety. With those kinds of examples beginning to crop up, will you change your attention or focus on how you're thinking about making up this $60 to $80 million versus what you might have been looking at, say, 4 weeks ago?
Well, I mean, we weren't 4 weeks ago, a little different situation with the budget. But, you know, I know you mentioned this Cambridge City Council. I mean, I'm going to be working with the Boston City Council. Many people have had different ideas as well. And, you know, I'm going to work with Boston, my council here in Boston, and we're going to be working towards seeing how we can look at and dealing with the budget as a whole and around the whole police question as a whole. You know, this is has been a very challenging time in our country, our city in particular. So I look forward to working with the council, collaborating to see how what some of their ideas are and recommendations are. This has to be a collaborative effort. This isn't about what Marty Walsh thinks about here in the city. We're all in this together.
So, Mayor Walsh, our lines are full of Bostonians right now. I'd like to get to some calls. I do want to put the number out because we will empty those lines for rooms for new callers. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Muhammad on the line from the South End. Muhammad, go ahead.
Yeah, Mayor Walsh, what is your position on the National Guard remaining in Boston despite the relatively low levels of violence that we really see in the streets, especially given they now serve mostly just to intimidate both protesters, but also the homeless population in Boston?
Thanks, Mohammed. Appreciate the question. You know, they're not there to intimidate anyone. They're there to make sure they can assist the police in the events of what happened a week ago Sunday. And we're going to be really scaling back in a big way today with the National Guard. And over the course of the next couple of days, I'm assuming you won't see them in Boston.
Let's take another call, Mayor Walsh. We have
Great
Kelly
question,
on the line from We have Kelly on the line from Dorchester. Kelly, go ahead.
Hi, I got to turn off my radio, I think.
Yep, definitely do that, Kelly. Kelly, are you there? Or we can come back to you.
I am there. Nope, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, Mayor Walsh. This is Kelly.
Hi, Kelly.
I'm calling because I was at the Franklin Park demonstration, and I was actually leaving, and all of a sudden, like 20 police motorcycles went roaring.
Kelly, I lost you.
I think we lost Kelly. All right, let's see if we can get Kelly back. In the meantime, let's take one other call here. We've got Steve on the line from Jamaica Plain. Steve, go ahead.
Hi, Mayor. I'm calling about a video that was put out by the Kirk Minahan Show of a site on the intersection of Mass Ave and Melnia Cass Boulevard, where it appears that the city is offering some services, and there are rumors that they're turning a blind eye to the drug trade and drug use. It's kind of a public health threat. Just wondering if you have any plans to enforce the laws around that area.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's obviously a very tough area, as far as very sad to see a lot of folks there that are struggling with addiction. There is enforcement going on there. There's also a lot of treatment going on there and intervention going on there. And we've been doing it for quite some time now. And it's really sad to see the amount of addiction that we're seeing in our city. Many people have come from all over the place to be there. And we have enforcement there, but we also have intervention going on there.
Mayor Walsh, we've got Kelly back. So before we go to a break, I'd like to get her question in. Kelly from Dorchester, jump right in, please.
Okay. So I was talking about the demonstration at Franklin Park and how at the very end, the police used very intimidating tactics and dangerous tactics, like 20 motorcycles with their lights on, their sirens on, several police cars went roaring from the Blue Hill Ave section down to Shattuck. I don't know exactly what happened in Shattuck, but there was nothing going on. There was no violence. And I don't know, the police really need to be retrained and have a different perspective. Like, they're there to protect people, not to scare them.
Let's take that back to Marty Walsh now. Kelly, Mayor Walsh?
No, I'm not sure the situation that Kelly's talking about, but I know that from the feedback that I received from that night was relatively peaceful as far as the police go. But one of President Obama's pledges for mayors, the first one, is to review your police's use of force policies. I think that's something. And also, number four, reform your community police use of force policies. There's four actually good points: review, engage, report, and reform. And I think that all of those, when President Obama was the president, Boston was at the table when the president came out with a 21st century police report. Boston was featured in that, and I think that it's time now for us to review, engage, report, and reform some of what we do. I don't know if that will help answer the question for Kelly, but that's something I think that we have to be looking at.
Mayor Walsh, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take more calls and continue to speak with you. I'm Tiziana Deering. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. There's more conversation in our Mondays with Mayor Marty Walsh ahead. This is Radio Boston. Mayor Walsh, thanks for sticking with us through the break. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So, Mayor Walsh, we had some questions, and I was talking to you about policing and the protests before the break. I've got some more calls I want to get in. Beforehand, I do want to ask you a particular question about officers. We had a caller before the break talking about Franklin Park and some what she experienced as aggressive behavior by the officers. You had told WCVB-TV that any officers with body cameras had them on during the protests. BUR asked Boston Police for records and body camera footage tied to protests last week, including the Sunday one a week ago this past Sunday. The department said they're not releasing that footage, claiming the investigation exemption, that they're involved in an ongoing investigation. We know that that exemption is voluntary. Will you push police to release body camera footage from those nights and other records that can shine light on what happened with police and protesters?
Well, yeah, let me look into that. I would appreciate you calling, giving me a little bit of notice on that. I would have had an answer for you if I had known that before. grateful you got on the show today. This is the first I've heard of it.
Appreciate you telling me that.
Let me look into it. So, next time, just on three questions, if there's anything that your listeners want answers to, if I have a little bit of notice, I can find it. I don't have that information off the top of my head.
Okay. We will check in with you on that one again. Let's take a call from Jeremy in Jamaica Plain, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeremy, go ahead.
Yes, hi, thank you. I'm a very proud Boston Public School parent of three kids, including a graduate this year. And I have been incredibly frustrated in the past by having to engage in battles with you, Mayor Walsh, over the budgets of the schools and fully funding them. My daughter, mm-hmm. for example, was one who walked out in the budget protests, and you seem to root that leadership in quote-unquote outside agitators when it really came from the students. So my question is, why should we trust you at this point to honestly engage in a debate about defunding the police when we haven't felt that support as Boston Public School parents until this point?
Well, I'm sorry you feel that way. I mean, over the last every budget since I've been mayor, we've increased funding to the schools significantly. And this year's budget is going to be the largest increase in probably almost since the beginning of schools. We're doing a $100 million increase directly over 3 years directly to new programming. It's not to pay increases of teacher salaries and collective bargaining raises. It's going right directly to schools. So I apologize you feel that way, but I know we have funded the schools even when we have gotten every year less and less state dollars. We have continually increased the school budget every year.
Let's take another call here because our lines are again full. We have Diana on the line from Jamaica Plain. Diana, go ahead.
Hey, Mayor Walsh. I just want to thank you for having these open discussions about really difficult subjects right now at this time. But I specifically wanted to ask, looking at the Boston Police Department in terms of training in their past and where they're going in their future, I'm not quite sure if this was part of Boston Police, but there has been a lot of Israeli training in police forces across the country. And are you committed to making sure that that doesn't continue and that we're not a part of that? That as training happens and changes, that it is more based on community contacts and really reaching out to different parts of areas that need support. And
Diana, let's give that back to the mayor now.
Thank you, Diana.
To answer your question.
You're absolutely right, Diana. I mean, I think that it's really important. This needs to be more emphasis on community policing, more emphasis on building relationships, less emphasis on arresting people. And I think that that's something that since I've been mayor and when it was Commissioner Evans at first and then Commissioner Gross now, our arrests are down in Boston since we became mayor. We made a lot of adjustments back in 2014-15. We worked with President Obama on the 21st Century Police Report, which he used a lot of what Boston's doing. We have anti-bias and de-escalation as part of our officer training from day one. But in saying all this, this is a different time, and it's time for us to go back. And there's constantly evolution of training and all of that. And I think we have to take another good deep dive and look at what we're doing as far as moving forward. But when Commissioner Gross created the Bureau of Community Engagement and Nora Bastian is the deputy, that's the intent behind this. And I think that we have to continue to make sure that the police continue to work on behalf of the communities in Boston. And so you're absolutely right. Thank you for bringing that up.
Mayor Walsh, I want to move on to the phase two and the reopening in just a minute. Before I do, you've talked a number of times over the last week about how you've been struck by listening to your own staff and their
Incredible.
Experiences in the city of Boston, especially the African-American and Black staff members on your team.
Yeah.
With that in mind, how does Boston heal and achieve greater racial justice moving forward?
I mean, we're going to be honest, it's going to be a long time. But when we talk about, and I mentioned this the other day, it's not just about me signing an executive order or making an announcement. It's about having real real systemic change. And, you know, I think that what I've done last week, a lot of last week, was just listening to people and understanding on where people are coming from. Quick example of this. I was on a call with the Black Employee Network here in the city, and there was a young woman on the call, and she was talking about her experiences with the police and her experiences with racism in the country, in the city. And then later in the week, I was on the call with the advisory board, and one of the people on my advisory board for COVID is a person that runs a venture capital fund, an African-American woman, and the experience is the same. And there's a consistent story here. And I think it's time for not all, because there's a lot of folks calling in that are passionate and have done a lot of work in racial equity that are calling in different parts of the city and the state. But it's time for all of us, the white people, really to listen and understand. If we want to make true change, we have to understand that. And certainly, you know, last week was very emotional in a lot of ways. And I said to a lot of people, but it was emotional and tough for me for 1 week, where for the Black community, it's been many times people's whole lives dealing with racism. And I think that that's what struck me. And now this week, as we move forward here, it's still time to listen, but it's also time now to set in place some real changes. I can't speak for leadership in this country. All I can do is do as much as I can for Boston and become an example moving forward. I think that's what we have to do. And having conversations, and they're difficult conversations. I know that there's a lot of people on the phone that want to ask me a lot of questions. They don't know where I'm coming from, and they won't ask me that. But just understand this, that I think we should be all coming from the same place to have true equity.
Mayor Walsh, we've got about a minute left, and I do want to acknowledge that today begins phase two of the reopening. How are you feeling about the reopening, and do you think this phase two, and do you feel like the city of Boston is ready and in the right place?
Well, I can't get too much into reopening. I only have a minute here, but I got to tell people still, like, when you're out there, we're asking people to continue to wear masks, continue to wash your hands as often as possible, continue to practice physical social distancing. Today, we only had 15 additional cases from yesterday, which brings our total to 13,026 cases, and 666 people have died in the city of Boston. We still have a lot of work to do. We're going to monitor the reopening really closely, and obviously with the protests and demonstrations, we're monitoring that as well to see if we have any spikes in cases, and just asking people we have to continue to understand and be careful and watch out for each other when it comes to COVID-19.
And that's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. I appreciate you joining us. We look forward to next month's Mondays with Mayor Walsh.
Thank you.